Okay. Proverbs 23. We'll start there at the beginning. This is, it's a chapter of warnings. There are a lot of things in this life that test our willpower, and the approach that Solomon takes with many of these things is do not. Just don't do them. And it's kind of ironic because in the religious world, it seems there's more and more of a push toward, well, we don't need to worry about the things, the rules, things, and all of that. Let's just focus on the love. Is God's love powerful? And do we need to understand and comprehend how, as best we can, how great it is? Of course. Does he have some rules? Yeah, he always has. So we can't. There are some times that the Bible says, don't do it. And we need to be willing when it says that to accept it. Here, you've got Solomon's wisdom on just an array of things. And notice as we go through it, just some of the common sense that's tied in with it. Look at the first three verses. This one, it kind of made me chuckle as I went through it and read it. It says, when you sit down to eat with a ruler. Okay, first of all, how often is that going to happen? For most of us. For most of us. So keep that in mind as we go through this. When you sit down to eat with a ruler, consider carefully what is before you and put a knife to your throat if you are a man given to appetite. Do not desire his delicacies, for they are deceptive food. Okay, most of us are not going to get this invitation. I seriously doubt that the president is ever going to invite me to dinner. I just don't see it happening. I may be wrong. If he does, I'm probably in trouble. But most of us, this is not a reality. So what if all of a sudden you get an invitation from the White House to just come by and have just come by and have a meal? What if the king sends a summons to you? Well, just come by and have dinner with me. What should your first reaction be? Suspicion. Be on guard, because this is not typical. This is not normally. Most of us don't run in those circles. If we suddenly get an invitation, be on guard, because the king may be trying to bribe us. The king may be trying to get us to do something that maybe we shouldn't. And the idea here, look at verse 2, put a knife to your throat if you are a man given to appetite. Don't let your stomach get you into trouble. You see the king's delicacies, you see all these good things, and you think, oh man, this is great. Look at this. I'm living it up. Be careful and don't turn your brain off. Pay attention to what's going on, because if you have never been invited into the presence of the king and all of a sudden he wants you to come have dinner with him, just be on guard, because something may not add up with all of that. What are his delicacies described as in verse 3?
Deception.
Deceptive food, yeah. These are deceptive. So here's a temptation. Just be careful. There may be something sinister behind all of this, and I don't need to let my appetite blind me. When I was reading, I thought about, and I know I'm going to tell it wrong, but you remember the story of Hansel and Gretel, two little kids, and they go off into the woods, and they find this house that's made of like gingerbread and candy, and the woman there just keeps feeding them candy and candy and candy, and they just get fatter and fatter and fatter. And then they find out she's a witch that's trying to fill them up so she can cook them and eat them. That's what I thought of. He gives us this great stuff just out of nowhere. And eventually he's going to cook us. There's something that he wants out of this. Anyway, don't sell yourself for a bribe, I think is one of the points we can take from this. Any comments on that section, first three verses? Okay. Look at 4 and 5. Do not overwork to be rich. Because of your own understanding, cease. Will you set your eyes on that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven. We've talked about this, and it's interesting to me that Proverbs talks about it a lot. This idea of being consumed with wealth and desiring to be wealthy so badly that it's just sort of this controlling thing. The ultimate irony for me in that, who's talking about this? Who's writing about this? The wealthiest guy, and yet, even so, he sees the dangers in it. And really, if anybody would have known how dangerous it could be, it certainly would have been him. He had the great wisdom, but also he had the experience to go with it. So when he talks about wealth, certainly I need to pay attention, see what he has to say. There's this warning, don't overwork to be rich. Now, let's not take it the wrong way. Are we to work? Yes, we're to work and work to have extra, if you go to Ephesians, to provide for others who are in need. So he's not telling us not to work. This is the whole purpose of this work that's being condemned in 4 is what? Why is it condemned?
Because that's your whole purpose.
Yeah, it is consuming. I want to be rich. Not so I can help others. I just want the wealth and I want everything that comes with it, the esteem and the prestige. I want all of that. If that's our primary goal in life, we're gonna have to deal with a lot of frustration and a lot of emptiness. And you know, if wealth truly was the answer, nobody in Hollywood would ever commit suicide. Right? But it happens more often than you would think. If wealth was really the answer, nobody would ever end their lives that had the wealth. But obviously that happens quite a bit. Notice how it's described. You also get this idea that the wealth is fleeting. How is it described in verse 5?
Fly away.
It'll sprout wings and fly away. Just when you can have it one moment and then it's gone the next. So it's not something that we can trust in. It's not a foundation that we can place our trust in. Is wealth good? Can it be good?
Yeah.
Proverbs has told us that. It is better to have wealth than to not, because when hard situations come, it does make things easier. But it can't be the foundation. It can't be our hope and our meaning in life, or it'll let us down every time. And we've talked about this idea, but when death comes, what happens to the wealth? Yeah, it stays and I go. And I'll never have it again. You know, I think we've made the joke before. How many times have you ever seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul? Probably none, right? It's just not going to do anybody any good at that point. Now, let's talk about the good side. If we are blessed, and we are, as a people, as a nation, we're blessed, what does God expect from that?
Do good.
Yeah, and that's the principle we see in 1 Timothy chapter 6. If you have it, do good with it. Charge those who are rich. Do good with the things that they have. So certainly that's what God expects from it. It is a tool, and it should never become more than a tool to us. Once riches become more than a tool, when they become a life goal and a drive, they've gotten out of their place. They've become too important in my life. They're a tool. I can use them, and I should use them for good. But when they get beyond that, something has gotten out of whack. Any thoughts? Any comments on any of those? Okay. Let's look at verses 6 through 8. Do not eat the bread of a miser, nor desire his delicacies. For as he thinks in his heart, so is he. Eat and drink, he says to you, but his heart is not with you. The morsel you have eaten, you will vomit up and waste your pleasant words. This kind of goes back to the first 3 verses. I think there's some similar principles being taught. What is a miser?
Man uses a stingy man.
Okay.
A stingy person.
Yeah, yeah. A miser is a stingy person, someone who loves money more than anything. And there are those who love money so much that they won't even spend it. They just kind of hoard it all up. And they're incredibly wealthy, but they actually live in awful conditions because they're not willing to part with the money even to buy basic things. You ever know anybody like that? Yeah, it's really a sad situation. But and instead of a miser, I think some of the versions have one who has an evil eye. Whatever the case is, this is not a godly person. This is not a person thinking about righteous things. Do not partake of his things. Don't, first of all, don't act like him. Don't partake of his ways and become like him. But if a miser, and we've talked about what that means, if he tells you, come and eat and drink of my things, what should you think? Something's wrong, man. Yeah, this is a guy who doesn't want to part with anything for even for himself sometimes. If he is smiling and offering you food and drink, you bet the red flags should come up. You better watch and see what's going on. A miser is somebody consumed with temporary things. Mark your places. Let's go to 2 Corinthians 4. I just want to look at a warning that Paul gives. about this idea of being consumed with the temporal, the temporary things of this world. 2 Corinthians 4, if someone will read 16 through 18 for us.
Therefore, we do not lose heart. But though the outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal.
Yeah, just this idea, focus your gaze on eternity and spiritual things, those things which are permanent. Don't get caught up in the physical. And this is sort of a side note, but verse 17 that Mike read, for our light affliction, which is but a moment. I smile every time I read Paul talking about a light affliction, because you go on later, what are some of his light afflictions?
Left for dead.
Yeah, I mean, you could turn over a few chapters, 2 Corinthians 11, 24. From the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus 1. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I've been in the deep. And we could keep reading. Those are his light afflictions. And then I read it, and I smile at first, and then I just say, I am so lame. The stuff that I let bother me and discourage me, what a wimp. You compare to what he went through, and he can say, hey, it's just for a little while. It's just light. Okay, they stoned me, but it was just for a little while. What an encouragement it should be to us. And I say all of that to say, focusing on the temporal, the temporary, it'll get in the way of heaven every time. And we see Paul cautioning us about that as well. So take that back to the miserly one and him who says, eat and drink, he says to you. This is verse 7 in Proverbs 23. But his heart is not with you. He may say it. He doesn't really mean it. He has something else driving his intentions here. The morsel you have eaten, you will vomit up and waste your pleasant words. It's not what it seems to be. Let's talk about associations for a second. We warned about associating with a miserly person that I might become that way. I need to be careful who I spend my time with, right? I need to be careful who I spend time around. Why is that?
People come to corrupt good habits.
It does, you know, and we read that, and I think that's a verse that we hear a lot, and we teach it to teenagers a lot, and I'm afraid they're just like, oh, whatever. Yeah, 1 Corinthians 15:33, I've got it. I got it. I know what it says. But why do we teach it so much?
It's true.
It is so true. It is so very true. And as we get older, we see it and we remember the times we didn't put the separation there that we should have and the stuff that it might have gotten us into. This is true. We can go, can you think of some examples, Bible examples of bad associations that led to trouble?
That the king's son had that friend that was telling him, David's son, they had a friend that was looking to tell them what to do about that half-sister is.
Yeah, Amnon's friend. Oh, man, what a mess. What a mess. And yet, here, when Amnon has those desires toward Tamar, what should his friend have been doing if he was righteous?
He's courageous.
What are you doing, Amnon? And just, no, you can't have these thoughts. You can't do these things. But yet, what was his friend doing?
Encourage him.
I got a plan to get her here with you alone. What a mess. And certainly that's the example that always, Mary, that one always comes to mind. It is that. Good. Any others you can think of?
But the king that listened to the younger people's advice instead of the wisdom of the older people. I forget.
Ray Bowen. Yep. Solomon's own son, who I believe a lot of this is written directly toward. My son, hear the words of your father. Well, who would Solomon's son, who would the crown prince have been? That's Rehoboam. I mean, this is aimed at him, and he's the very one that does that. He refuses the wisdom of the older men who had been with his father and seen so many things. He takes the wisdom of his buddies, and we certainly see the kingdom ends up being split shortly after that between him and Jeroboam. Good thought. Anything else on any of that? Steve, go ahead.
The verse Mike used, evil companions corrupt good morals. You're talking about teaching it to teenagers. A lot of times that's all we think it applies to. don't carry it farther than the black to ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I get into dangerous companionships? Can I do that after I'm out of my team? Yeah, you certainly can. With work, we can get connected with people that would lead us down a path we shouldn't go. Again, let's talk about it from this perspective. Do we need to come in contact with people who aren't godly? We do, because you're never going to lead anybody to the Lord if you never come in contact with those who are away from Him. But at the same time, there's that warning to be careful. So how do we do it? How do you? Let's make a practical application from this. How do you do it?
You just got to pay attention to what you're doing with them.
Yeah.
You know, what activities you're partaking in with them. Mm-hmm. You know, is this something where you have an opportunity to teach, or is this something where they're influencing you to do something you shouldn't be doing?
Yeah.
You're not going to teach them by doing those activities that are wrong.
That's it. Eyes wide open. Right, paying attention to everything. Don't just kind of do the old ostrich head in the sand thing and pretend that it's not going on. Pay attention. And might you err on the side of caution sometimes? That's okay. It's okay to do that. And I mentioned before, Sasha tells me I'm paranoid, and that's fine. I don't care. I'd rather be a little cautious than end up in a pit realizing, how did I get here? How do I get out of here? So it certainly, we need to be aware. Good thoughts, Mike. Anything else on this? Okay. Well, we'll just look at 9 by itself, and then we'll come back and talk about 10 through 12. 9, do not speak in the hearing of a fool, for he will despise the wisdom of your words. And I know when we first started studying Proverbs, we talked about the difference between the fool and the stupid one. Typically, the fool is the one who is ignorant and doesn't have the knowledge, and the stupid one is the one who doesn't want the knowledge. He just wants to keep doing. It uses the word fool here, but in the context, I think this is talking about the one who wants to be a fool on purpose. He just won't hear wisdom. He refuses to listen to it. Has no use for God's truth. Doesn't want it. Turn to John 3. Jesus mentions this attitude. And again, I think the man of verse 9 is more along the lines of a scoffer, one who rejects truth. Here in John 3, could get someone to read 19 through 21 for us.
And this is the condemnation, that light is come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. But everyone that doeth evil hateth the light, neither cometh to the light, lest his deeds should be reproved. But he that doeth truth cometh to the light, that his deeds may be made manifest, that they are wrought in God.
Okay, thanks, Warren. What's the point of this? Jesus telling about certain people's hearts, and what is his point? What do some... Go ahead.
Evil person doesn't want to be revealed as being evil, so he doesn't come into the light.
Some prefer the darkness. Some, they don't like the light. Because what does the light do?
It exposes.
There's the word. There's the word, and we see that in other places in the New Testament. It exposes. It exposes what's in the darkness. And what's in the darkness is not good. So it would rather keep the lights turned off. And there's some who would just rather remain in the darkness. Don't tell me. Don't tell me. I don't want to know. I would just rather stay where I am. I'm happy right here. And that's one of those cases. We talked about knowing and being wise. Jesus talks about there may be opportunities where you are casting your pearls before swine. This may be one of them, right? There are those we study with, and we desperately want them to obey. Sometimes, do you have somebody whose heart is just hardened, and you're spending time and time and time, and they don't want to know truth. They don't really want to change. I'm not saying it's impossible, but until their heart changes, you're just kind of spinning your wheels. And that's something. It certainly requires wisdom. How long do you spend? I don't know. And I think it's probably different with everyone. But there comes a time when there are people that I have thought, surely surely they're going to obey the gospel. This is a good guy. I mean, he's solid morally. He's just the best guy you could ask for. And you spend time and time and time and time. But his heart was hardened toward truth. He's a nice guy, but he didn't want truth. And then there are people who morally, you look at them and you think, this guy, he doesn't want truth. But you say, you know what? That's not my place to judge. We're just going to study. And what do? Just wholeheartedly. Just grab it and hold on to it and just choke the life out. I mean, they are just like a drowning man grabbing onto a life preserver. And what happens to the immorality? They put it away because the Lord says to. And so, again, we talk about that. We've talked about the parable of the sower. Sling the seed and don't be restrictive on, and don't jump to conclusions. But at the same time, there will come a time with some where we have to say, all right, I need to go teach somebody else. This is just, this person doesn't want to hear it, at least not right now. Maybe not from me. Maybe someone else can get through, but I need to study with someone else. Okay, any thoughts on that? Let's look at 10 through 12. Proverbs 23, 10 through 12. This is actually, we in the previous chapter, verse 28, we touched on this idea of not removing the ancient landmark. And we're told that in verse 10. It says, "Nor enter the fields of the fatherless, for their Redeemer is mighty, and He will plead their cause against you. Apply your heart to instruction and your ears to words of knowledge." Physically, and we mentioned this last week, the landmark is, it would have been a boundary line, a boundary marker that showed where someone, the extent of someone's property. And by moving the boundary line, what would you be doing? Or attempting to do?
Well, attempting to steal property.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. You're cheating them out of property. You're saying, I mean, the understanding here is that you would have property next to theirs, and if you take the boundary line and move it over, you're taking away from theirs and giving it to yourself. You're cheating them. You're stealing from them, stealing property from them. That's the physical idea. We made the application last week, the spiritual application, about not going beyond, not moving the boundary lines. Who set the boundaries of what is right and what's wrong? God has, and I have no right to move those. Is it a temptation to move them? Sure. Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, let's just be honest. It is. We get in situations in our own lives where we might think, you know, I would prefer it if the boundary line were here. And so there's the temptation, but we can't move them. Stay true to the boundary lines there. Notice what's mentioned in verse 11, "For their Redeemer is mighty. He will plead their cause against you." I think the primary focus here is mistreating those who are poor and helpless. That's what Solomon's really focusing on. Those who are not in a position to really defend themselves, and you may be in a position of advantage over them, so you take advantage of them. And Solomon says, they have a mighty avenger. They have one who will plead their case for them, and you don't want to run afoul of him. Certainly God knows when we would mistreat someone, we would take advantage of them. So what should we be doing when we come in contact with those who are in a lesser position, if you will? What should we do? Yeah, do good. And I mean, that's a simple answer, but it's true. Do what's right. Do good toward them as much as we can. Yeah, I think we talked, I won't go back into it again. We talked last week about, you know, people calling and scamming older people on the phones and taking advantage and preying on them. That's the exact thing that's being warned against here. Good. Any thoughts? Okay. Let's look at 13 and 14. This also is a topic that we've looked at the past couple of weeks. It's mentioned here again. "Do not withhold correction from a child, for if you beat him with a rod, he will not die. You shall beat him with a rod and deliver his soul from hell." Is this talking about child abuse? No, not at all. The point here is that firm correction will not kill a child. Rather, what will it do? And that's a pretty big deal, right? To save a soul from hell, you know, that should be something we're very interested in. So how does discipline save a soul from hell?
Teaches them the difference between right and wrong.
Yeah, it does. And if they understand to respect the authority of those parents who have that authority over them, then they'll certainly be more likely to respect the authority of God who has all authority over them. You know, I was spanked as a child. It did not turn me into a psychopathic killer. It didn't. And I don't think it's going to. I think I'm pretty much set on that. But what it did was make me someone who respected what authority meant. And I knew that when the boundary lines were set and I crossed over them, what did I know? Bobby was going to give it to me. I mean, there was no question. When here was the line, and I knew, and I just rebelled against what he said, it was coming. And what does that do? That helps us understand right and wrong. It helps us understand authority and appreciate it. I'm glad he did. And I'm glad that my mother did as well. I'm just thankful for it. And I hope that my girls will in a couple decades as well. So not anytime soon, but hopefully they will. What if we don't have that? What if the lines are never drawn? Yeah, John.
If you don't see any authority and punishment throughout your life, you're not going to know what it feels like until you're dead and you're facing God.
You know, and on that, I think of Adonijah every time. David's son, Adonijah. What was his life like growing up? Father never told him no. Can you tell? When you read the story of how things go with Adonijah, can you tell he's never been told no? Yeah. I don't think Absalom was told no a whole lot either. I'm not specifically told that, but based on his behavior, I don't think he got a whole lot of no's either. And we can tell because they were rebellious. They rejected the authority of their father. And so who else's authority did they reject? God's. And they turned directly against him to... certainly Absalom trying to usurp the very throne that God had given to his father. So this, I know that's an extreme example, but where else does it lead? A lack of authority, where is it going to lead every time?
Sin
and rebellion. Every single time it will. Good. 15 and 16, let's put this together. My son, if your heart is wise, my heart will rejoice. Indeed, I myself, yes, my inmost being, will rejoice when your lips speak right things. I've only experienced this in a little taste, but I will tell you it is fantastic. When your kids, unbidden, say something that is right and good and something that God would approve of, it is the best feeling in the entire world. Now, and they're little, and I know. I can only imagine when your children are grown and they speak God's things from their lips, what it must feel like to a parent. It must be the absolute greatest thing that you can experience. And that's what Solomon is saying. With all of his wisdom, he's saying, son, if your heart is wise, it makes my heart rejoice. When you do what's right, that brings me this ultimate joy. Because there is something, and you see it in the spiritual sense, when John is writing to Christians, and he talks about how he has no greater joy than to know that his children are walking in the faith and walking righteously. How much is it in the physical sense for between a parent and a child when they see that? Certainly incredible. His lips speak of godly things instead of selfish things. It honors the parents. It honors God, and is good all around. Okay, anything else on this, on the discipline or verses 15 and 16? Any of those? Okay, let's try to get a couple more in. Verses 17 and 18. It's important to talk about. Do not let your heart envy sinners, but be zealous for the fear of the Lord all the day. For surely there is a hereafter, and your hope will not be cut off. Is there a temptation to envy sinners?
Yeah.
It is. Why? John, go ahead.
Sometimes they make sin look like it appeals like it's fun. Hey, do this. It's pleasurable for you. Or, you know, it might look like, short-sighted, it might look like something that will be fun to do right now, even though it's not the right thing. Yeah. And they try to draw you in with it. But you don't want to be jealous of that. He's saying don't be jealous of it because you know, hereafter you're going to have to say why you done it.
That, and that's the thing. He makes a connection with surely there's a hereafter, which means all of the stuff that looks good now, it will have to be answered for. There is a judgment. There is a hereafter. It looks like a life of sin. A lot of times it is made to look glamorous and fun. And because why? Let me ask you this. Why does that lifestyle appeal so much to so many?
Satan wants it to appeal to you and it looks good to you. You see all of the commercials about alcohol and stuff. Everybody is happy and grinning and jolly.
Sure.
And you know, you guys, that's got to be a good life. Yeah. I want to be like that.
Yeah. It. Go ahead, Steve.
It appears pleasant to the flesh, but you don't really see the consequences.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Matt.
I was just going to say, you don't really have to practice any restraint and self-control. Yeah. That lifestyle, you can just let it rise.
Yeah, I think that is one of the biggest appeals is no rules. Just do whatever. Just do whatever comes to mind, whatever. There's no self-control. Is self-control hard sometimes?
Yeah.
Does it lead to not doing everything you might want to do that the flesh might want? Sure. But then we if we look at a life of sin, it just looks like everything's open. Just do whatever you like. Mike, Jim?
It also looks easy.
Yeah.
And I don't know anybody that thinks work's fun. But a lot of things come from hard work. And when you look at people that are sinful and they're getting things in life that seem to be easy and seem to be fun when they're not behaving properly. They cheat, they don't treat people right. Just all in the name of a dollar.
Yeah.
So it's that allure of, hey, that's more fun, it's easier. It just seems tempting.
Yeah. It is. Jeff?
I think what the warning here is following the trend of a non-Christian. They are, you said it earlier, they are good people out there, but they live a life of selecting that he decides is good. But then following the will of God, you don't have that choice. He's only interested in that part of the discipline that is okay with him. And when you find yourself behaving, following the discipline of a person who does not have the will of God in his heart, then you're going to make that mistake. Say, oh, drinking is okay as long as I've got it under control. But that's not the discipline that we should follow. We know the temptation that's going to be there if you find yourself indulging in that behavior. Let's say you went to a party and you had too many, but that's not something that you normally do. But unfortunately, on your way home, you crash your car, you brought injury to somebody that you normally would not. But if you just stayed away from that drink, then that temptation never would have been there. I just use that as an example.
Sure.
But see, the will of God is such that we should be on guard day in and day out to resist those temptations that occur when we let our guards down.
Yeah.
I think these disciplines that are talked about here is following the strict guideline that a Christian should follow. And when you start looking at the behavior of the world because it's tempting, that's when it gets you in trouble.
Yeah, and someone mentioned that the very first thing that someone said was because Satan makes it look good. Satan makes it look, it does look easy, and it looks fun, and it looks great. And we talked about one of those commercials, and everybody's laughing and dancing and everything. You never see somebody in a morgue in one of those commercials, do you? You never see any of that stuff because they don't want you to see that. Just see the light, the shining and the glimmery things. Just see the shinies. That's all that's there. And this is the warning. There's so much more. Now let's not go on the other extreme. I think some people think, well, if I can't live the life of the world, then I'll just be miserable. I'll just be grumpy and miserable, and I'll come to services every Sunday, and I'll worship the Lord, and it'll be fantastic. I mean, it's just this awful weight. Because what is the next thing he says in verse 17? Don't let your heart envy sinners, but be what? Yeah, zealous. It doesn't mean that you're lifeless because you reject those things. Can you be excited about godly things? You must be. We must be. Be zealous for the fear of the Lord, certainly. Do you fear Him? I fear Him. Do you love Him? Yeah, sure. Hey, we respect Him, and Lord willing, we honor Him. And good things come from it. And it goes back to a point John made in verse 18. Surely there is a hereafter. And if you do follow His things, your hope will not be cut off. Good things for eternity are waiting on you. And that's the focus. That's the thing that gets us through it. And does it sometimes appear that the wicked win in this world? It does. I mean, just call it like it is. It seems like the wicked have the success a lot of times, and they have the good life, as we might call it. But there is a hereafter. And all of those things will be weighed and balanced in judgment. John?
It's like anything good worth working for,
Yeah. It
isn't free and it isn't easy.
Yeah,
he was talking about work. You might be sore afterwards, but you get paid for it. And, you know, you're going to be a Christian, you're going to suffer. You might suffer for a long time. You'll get rewarded for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to be easy or everyone would do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And nobody would ever fall away if it were easy. They'd just stay with Mike when I had to.
Mike, there are some words that jump out to me more than others. And when I look at verse 17, the second part of it says, but live in fear of the Lord always. Oh. You know, when I think about when you first obey the gospel, most of the time it's because you learn that you've sinned and you learn that hell waits for people who have sinned. And we think about the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge in the beginning of Proverbs.
Yeah.
And we want to serve the Lord because we love Him. We want to get away from that fear, but it better always be there.
Yeah.
Because when I look at those temptations, they should scare me. You know, they are tempting and they do allure us, but I should always fear the Lord. So when I see those things, there should be a little fear in me. Like, oh, I know where that could get you.
Yeah. Hey, I'm glad you brought that up. It made me think of something. I was having a discussion with a friend of mine this week about an invitation that a young man gave on Wednesday night. And his point was, we should not see God as a slave driver. He said, rather, I choose to see Him as a big teddy bear whose arms just wrap around me. Now, and as soon as my friend said that, I said, oh, no. And I could just imagine where those points are going. We should not see God as a slave driver. That's right. We should not see Him as a teddy bear either. That's not right. And see, that's what typically happens when these things come up, these discussions. It's extreme. It's the extreme of a slave driver or the extreme of a fluffy cloud. Well, where is God? Is there justice and command from Him?
Yes. Yeah.
Is there love and peace and comfort with Him?
Yes.
Which one?
Both.
And when you take either one of them and ignore the other side, it's not God. It's some version of Him that we've made up. He is justice, and I must fear that. As Mike said, I better always fear and understand His justice. But He is love, and He is grace, and He is mercy, and I need to accept that too, because if I don't see that side of Him, I will be miserable. I'll be a checklist guy who's like, all right, well, went to church, okay. And I have to see both sides of His character, because I have to have both sides of this character, of that character in myself. And, you know, and that, I don't know, and all right, I'll step away, but that's just one of my pet peeves right now, is that extremism that just blasts God one way or another. He is both justice and love. And if I don't see Him that way, I'm not seeing Him correctly. And I saw some hands. Jeff, go ahead.
Usually what I see when one wants to label God or categorize his discipline as being a slave driver are those that really don't want to do the righteous thing. He's looking for loopholes. You're looking for a way around doing the righteous thing,
yeah.
Living the life behaving in a manner that is godlike, and I really can't see an individual who look at God as a slave driver, and I really can't see an individual who look at God as being this big old cuddly kind of teddy bear who's going to let me get away with anything I want. Usually you're going to find a non-righteous person going either way, and when you're straddling the fence like that, you're really not behaving in the manner that God wants you to.
You know, the whole thing about the slave driver, the things that God tells me, that warns me against, if I heed those warnings, what does it mean for me? And I'm not even talking about in eternity. I'm just talking about in this life right now. If I take heed to the warnings He gives me, what will it mean for me in this life? Won't it be better? Even in this life. I mean, eternity aside for a second. If I don't treat people badly, and I don't steal, and I don't lie to people, will it be better for me in this life? Yeah, my relationship with people will be much better. So even the things that might deny us some things, it's not slavery. It's a warning that actually has our ultimate good in mind. I'm glad you brought that up. Go ahead, finish, Joe. Sorry.
And I think a perfect example of that from a scripture perspective is look at the example the Pharisees were setting for the people around them.
Yeah.
The people that they led. If you follow their teaching, that you really are straying away from the teaching that Christ was presenting the people with. This don't do as I do, do as I say to you. Well, what he is teaching is okay, but the law of Moses says that I can do it a different way. You just follow me and then you'll be okay. That was not what Christ was presenting to people. And I think you see that often in, quote, what is being taught, what is being led by the society that we live in right now. You know, I was just blown away the other day when I saw this news reel on this young kid. The judge sentenced him, gave him this life sentence because, as he put it, this kid behaved the way he did. He killed these people because he was just swarmed with riches. He was consumed with riches. And he got this life sentence, and then what did he do? He breaks the rules of his probation, and then he runs. And then his mother run with him. You'd be surprised at the people who think that society was being nice to him. That life sentence he got was okay because he was consumed with riches. And I think that this is a bad example. You don't see the world up in arms over what had happened.
Yeah.
What you do see the world up in arms over is some poor kid who has nothing that broke the law and did whatever it is he did. We tend to protect in spite of the fact we say that riches is not evil, but when I look at the scripture, you don't see the scripture teaching us to have a good time every day. You don't find that in what is taught us as God-fearing people. Fearing God does not mean that you get up in the morning time with one mindset, oh, I'm just going to have a good time today. I'm going to have a good time. That's not what the fear of God is teaching us.
Yeah. We're and often taught the exact opposite, to deny self.
Exactly.
And certainly the idea of responsibility is taught throughout the scriptures, Old Testament, New Testament. And that is, as we mentioned many times, something our society has no tolerance for, accountability and responsibility. Yeah. Okay, guys, let's stop there. I've gone over. Sorry about that. We'll plan to pick up. We might talk just a little bit more about verse 18 as we start class next Sunday.